Winston Churchill was once at a graduation in Canada. And it was before noon, but they knew the great man loved whiskey, so they offered him some. He didn't regularly drink before noon, but since he loved whiskey, he took some. And since he took some, they went down the entire top table, and every one of them took a glass of whiskey. Until they got to a bishop at the end of the line. He was evidently a small man, who stood up to his full height and said, "No, thank you. I would rather commit adultery than drink whiskey." Churchill heard this and said, "Please come back. I didn't know we had a choice today." Now, I start there because you all know that people like Richard Dawkins call Christian believers faith heads. And he'll go on making insults like that forever, whatever the argument against him is. But sadly, some Christians have earned that sort of an insult by the way they presented the faith. But obviously, that's not the sort of thing at Cambridge. And over these few days, I've tried to argue for what Socrates called the examined life, so that anyone coming to faith can really have a faith that, again, take another great Cambridge thinker, Sir John Polkinghorne, what he always stressed was a warranted belief. And that's been my concern. An examined life and a warranted belief. And today we come to the last, and we could go into all sorts of areas, the whole question of purpose. A few years ago, I was at the University of Shanghai in the business school at what was called China's CEO Forum, a fascinating time. And at the end of the conference, I was walking back from the last banquet to the lecture hall with the dean of the business school, and he said, "Let me ask you a question I wouldn't ask in public. We in China are fascinated with the Christian roots of your Western past to see what China can learn for its future. But you in the West are cutting off your roots. What am I missing?" I said to him, "Frankly, you're not missing anything. Our Western culture, which was once grounded in Jewish and Christian ideas, is today a cut flower civilization. You could give it fancier academic terms, a crisis of legitimation, a crisis of cultural authority or whatever, but it's essentially a cut flower civilization. And one of the effects is we have a yawning vacuum under many of the great ideas and the ideals that have made the West. At one point, we have a conflict of voices, all offering different answers to the old questions. At another place, we often have people using the same words, but giving them different meanings. And then again, there are people stressing the old ideas, but often with no foundations at all. And the effect is a growing vacuum. Maybe the deepest of all the things at stake, and your generation will reap the consequences of this, is the crisis of human dignity. But I want to raise one that's a lesser one, but a very important one for us as individuals, the crisis of purpose. It isn't just people your age launching out on life. I was at a conference near Oxford some years ago, and as the final wrap-up session was starting, one of the people there, who was incredibly wealthy, he said, "As you know, I've made a lot of money in life." Everyone knew he had. He said, "To be honest, one of my driving motives was to hire people to do what I don't like doing." And everyone thought he was working up towards some joke. But then he almost choked up, and a tear rolled down his face. And he said, "The trouble, I've never been able to hire anyone to discover my sense of purpose and fulfillment in life." Not long ago, I was speaking in Silicon Valley. And there were about 30 people there, and after a dinner, and there were centimillionaires and people who'd made fortunes in all the IT explosion. As we talked afterwards, six of them used the term "something more." These were all enormous successes, but they wanted something more. I came into London not long ago and saw this graffiti on a wall. very different sort of level of spectrum from what I've just said. You only live once, and it won't last. So live it up, drink it down, laugh it off, spend it all, burn it at both ends, leave no regrets. You can't take it with you. There was briefly in the American campuses a so-called YOLO movement. You only live once. But whether it's the YOLO movement or the people behind that graffiti, who of course were writing a kind of bastardized Epicureanism, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, what they forget when they talk about YOLO, you only live once, so seize the day, is the final three or two words that used to be attached to it. You only live once. Do you know what used to be there too? If then. You only live once, if then. In other words, it raises the question, how do we so live to truly have purpose in this life? Now, if you've talked to people really getting into that or being disillusioned with that, and Richard's given us examples early in the week, you can see there's a whole number of false solutions. A lot of people are pursuing things that are merely circular. Huge amount of life is like that. We eat, we drink, we sleep, we work, but actually just to keep going. And those things in themselves never really give you the purpose of life. But then there's another dead end where those who are looking in the wrong places. Business circles have a little question, is your ladder up against the right wall? Because many people have climbed their ladder with great, great success and found it was up against the wrong building. And what they thought was success just didn't give it. Or again, there's a third obvious inadequacy, those who pursue things that are just too small. Tom Landry, who was the legendary coach of the Dallas Cowboys, he once quoted that famous American saying about sports, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. But the day after the Super Bowl, it's nothing. Because you've done it, and what then? I remember many years ago, in my first trip to Australia, my wife and I met Shane Gould, who was the first woman to win 5 gold medals in swimming. And she was the grand old age of 15, and she was deeply suicidally depressed because life was over. She'd done it. And what then? So the question is, what really gives you a purpose? Now, many of you know, having read Aristotle, he talks about things that are teleological, that are driving towards an end. And you remember Søren Kierkegaard used to say, life must be understood backwards, but has to be lived forwards. And as Aristotle points out, when you live with a sense of the end, you have to have an end that is truly an end in itself, that finally satisfies and stops all the searching and isn't circular. Isn't the wrong one, isn't something that's too small. And so the question is, as you finish at Cambridge and launch out in your lives, what is that end to you? Now here again you can see very clearly the essence of the comparative that I was talking about, particularly on Tuesday. Because if you look at the different worldviews, they give you dramatically, decisively different answers about purpose. I mentioned it briefly on Tuesday. But what does the East say about individual purpose and fulfillment? Forget it. What's the goal of Hinduism? That just as the salt merges into water or the river runs into the sea, so the individual who at the moment is, quote, God's temporary self-forgetfulness, can rediscover itself by merging beyond personality, back with the impersonal ground of being. And you have essentially the same thing in Buddhism. As I said, at Bodh Gaya, when Buddha was liberated and enlightened, he didn't say, "I am liberated." He said, "It is liberated." He'd achieved what they called the not-self. One of his followers, Buddha Gosa, used to say, "I am nowhere a somewhatness for anybody." Figure that one out. D.T. Suzuki, the great Zen master, was very popular in the 1960s, used to say, "The goal of Zen, let's be clear, is excarnation." Not incarnation, he said. That's Christian. In other words, freedom in that understanding is freedom from individuality, freedom from individual personality. Because when we take ourselves seriously as individuals, it's part of what is involved of being caught in the world of maya or illusion. Now you have in the West what's called boomer Buddhism. A little meditation in the lunch hour to keep your pulse rate down or slow yourself down in the craziness of fast life. But that's cheating. If you really look at where they lead consistently, the consequences are much more radical than that. And you do not have a high view of individual purpose in the East. Again, how about the secularist family of faith? You have strong purpose there. But it is all, as I said earlier, do it yourself. Nietzsche's famous for his argument and the way he put it. "You have so to live," he says, "that at the end you can say, thus I willed it." Ayn Rand, his follower, who's read widely today, Atlas Shrugged and so on, she says, "You've got to live your life in every stage so that you say at the end of it, and I meant it." Or as I said, Bertrand Russell used to say to us at London, "Think of the Greek Atlas, the Greek giant Atlas, carrying his own universe of his own meaning on his own shoulders." That's what you have to do. No meaning out there. No great purpose out there. Any purpose you want, you create it for yourself. You carry it forward yourself. Now, most people know very well they can't do that. And it appeals to the young and the wealthy and the healthy and so on. But if you see it carried out, you see characters like John Galt in Atlas Shrugged, who describes his philosophy as depending on nobody and having nobody depending on him. And when you get down to, say, the critiques of capitalism, it washes out well, and you get away from all sorts of forms of socialist dependency and that sort of stuff. But when you come to family relationships, and even things like love becoming that radical selfish individualism, you have a very different world that leads to a loneliness that as people gets over simply doesn't wash. But look at it. I keep saying to you, don't take my word for it. Read A Free Man's Worship. Read many of these great classics and ask yourself, will that give you the purpose that will satisfy you your whole lives? Where does the Jewish and Christian understanding of purpose come from? Well, you could root it at many points. For myself, I think one of the sharpest points is the notion of calling. Just as God says, "Let there be light," and a cosmos springs into being packed with design and information, so God says to individuals, especially through Jesus, "Follow me." And as people rise to follow him, they enter into a purpose for their lives that's higher and richer and deeper than anything they could fathom for themselves. Because God knows us far better than we know ourselves. God knows us better than the closest, our families, our deepest friends know ourselves. And he knows just where we are today and where we can be. And if you understand that whole notion of calling, it's not just a matter of be who you are. That's wonderful enough in itself. We're created unique. There's no one in all history and all the universe like each of you, with your blend of gifts and aspirations and personality, no one like you. And calling is certainly, as God speaks to you, be who you are. But that's not the end of it. Be who you are, yes. But become whom you can be. And God, who's created you, calls you. And as you rise to follow his call, you enter into purposes the like of which you'll never see anywhere else. That's the deepest source of purpose the world has ever seen. And if you know the course of Western history, you could say those two words, follow me, have in many ways shaped the world. They were lost for many centuries, the whole notion of calling. Sadly, at sometimes they were made spiritual and just left calling for the monks and the nuns and priests. But the Reformation recovered them and recovered the dignity of work and the dignity of all sorts of things in many areas, and in many ways is one of the truths that has shaped our modern world, as Max Weber and many others have pointed out so powerfully. So I would challenge you to think of this. You want to pass exams. You want to move out. You may want to get married. You may want to succeed in business. But look at all the goals you have and ask yourself, are they purely circular? Are they the wrong sort of goals? Are they too small? Or do you truly have a purpose that is big enough and lasting enough to be the whole of your life? Walker Percy, the American novelist, used to say, you can get all A's and still flunk life. We have our Rhodes Scholars at Oxford. You know how we describe them? Rhodes Scholars are people with a great future in their past. Very few of them fulfill the potential that they're so lauded for early on. Only those who have true and genuine, lasting purpose. Let me just tell you as I finish, and in our question time today, we can go over any of what we said all this week. Let me just tell you the story of how my own wife came to faith and discovered her purpose. My wife's American. She went to university, one of the best ones in California. And on a whim, one summer, she tried some fashion modeling and fell into it and did well. And a year and a half later, she found herself having gone from San Francisco to Toronto, to Paris, to New York. She found herself, she worked hard, of course, engaged to a French baron who was the windsurf champion of the world and a mega millionaire with Rolls Royces in Paris and New York. And she'd been by that stage on the front cover of Vogue 6 times. And the world was, quote, her oyster. But I talked about a signal of transcendence, if you remember, the other day. And hers came with all this extraordinary wealth in the middle of the Vietnam War and all that was going on in the 60s. She would fly to Paris for the weekend. And one weekend, she knew Salvador Dali, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, people like that. One weekend, she was at a party in Salvador Dali's flat in the Meurice Hotel in Paris. And he always had, in the middle, a great salvo with champagne, and chained to the legs of the table on which he was sitting, a cheetah. And it was drugged, defanged, declawed, and all that. And all the people, the women in their fancy 60s dresses, and the men with their Nero jackets and so on. And my wife was, obviously not my wife then, she was looking at this cheetah, and she was suddenly horrified by the contrast between what it had been made to be and the glory of what this great animal should have been. But then she looked round the room, and she thought, we're all much the same. And this fancy dress parade is incredibly hollow. And it was as if an abyss opened up in the middle of that party. And she said, I've got to search for the meaning of life. She was an atheist, out of an atheist family, and she searched. Went back to New York and said, where do I look? And someone said, well, you go down to the local metaphysician. And they put her in touch with a medium who arranged the weather for Vogue. Little session or two with her dissatisfied her. She went into Buddhism and Hinduism and all sorts of things. And finally, not getting anywhere, she was reminding me last night, she just prayed very simply, not knowing God as an atheist. God, she said, I can't find you. If you're there, find me. And out of that, she did. And mercifully went a different way, and we met later in Switzerland. So I would challenge each of you at the end of this week, the examined life. The search begins with that time for questions, with something that makes you think more deeply and care more deeply about really making sense of this world. Then as you look, the answers. There are only so many answers in the room. You've got to look for yourself. You know what I think the answer is. You've got to look for yourself at all the alternatives and truly see which you believe is the most adequate. And then, as many of you have pointed out, something might look very adequate, but be, as one of the questioners said, nice and comforting. No, no. No one should believe for that reason. The only reason to believe in any faith is that you are convinced with all the powers of your mind that it is true. True to what is and solid and substantial. But of course, that isn't the end of it either. And that's why this is the fourth step in what I was arguing for. Those who've raised questions, who've looked at answers, who are attracted by what they believe is true. The fourth step is a time for commitments. I said when we looked at answers, it's a conceptual stage. Someone has been challenged and they're sending their mind out like a scout to look at things. It's a more conceptual stage. And the third one is true in terms of the truthfulness. But we, of course, are not just minds. We have minds, thank God. We have hearts and we have wills and we are whole people. And the fourth stage is the stage when it all comes together as whole people. In fact, you always see when people come to faith, and unlike Søren Kierkegaard, it is not a leap of faith or a leap in the dark. No, you can see the examined life and the warranted faith is thoroughly reasonable. But when you come to that step, there's an extraordinary paradox, and C.S. Lewis, who is here, shows it very clearly in his own story. On the one hand, people who make the step of faith, they know that it is the freest, most responsible, wholehearted thing they have ever done. It is them and all of them. But on the other hand, and here's the paradox, that's always the stage when suddenly you're aware for the first time, it isn't just us. We haven't just found God, as it were. He has found us. And both come together. Now, someone raised the question, do Christians believe they've arrived? No, of course not. Jesus said, I am the way. So the journey of a searcher is looking at all the possibilities in order to commit himself or herself to the beginning of the way. And there's a whole lifetime of following the way. So there are two extremes today. One extreme is the idiots who think they've arrived. Never ask any more questions. Never open themselves to any more challenges. Not at all. That's wrong. None of us have arrived. The other extreme, though, is the more modern and the secular idea that there's no arrival anyway. Better to journey hopefully than ever to arrive, as it puts today. But if you think, that's really forlorn. We are journeying to a destination. And in fact, in the Christian view, we are journeying home. And one day we'll see our Father. But it is only the beginning, and there's a lifetime. That's the whole of the way. So I challenge you to think through, where are you in terms of this?